before I go on to talk about the main things I want to address, I just want to say what an honour it actually is to be here with Ambassador Zimberg and with Jody Brown from Red Cross, because it was the coalition of civil society organisations, most notably ICANN, but others such as Reaching Critical Will in the United States and others in different parts of the world, together with a set of remarkably, resilient, that's boring, governments which were determined to keep going and under really very considerable pressure. And I'm thinking of the governments at certain stages of Norway, but subsequently Mexico, Austria, Nigeria, Ireland, South Africa. The proponents of the movement at the United Nations in particular, which was important. But in particular, I also want to mention the International Committee of the Red Cross, which really started much of this off. And I think that's a new model in global politics that we need to pay attention to. So I thank Humphrey for his kind words about that. Let me go back and pay my respects to the elders of the Namadgi people and the continuing, ongoing, never-ceded Aboriginal possession of this land. Humphrey mentioned that's become a matter of convention, and I actually think that's a good thing after 200 years of exact opposite. Perhaps more importantly, it points us towards something which is quite fundamental in some of the issues we're talking about today. And in particular, I'm thinking of the way in which, if you like, in international relations speak, how you conceive of your national strategic interests and who you think you are, your national identity, are actually quite closely related. Geography may be permanent, but how you read the map probably depends on what you think is important because of who you are. And so the issues of that long war against Indigenous people and our inability to wean ourselves off empire that Humphrey alluded to earlier, I think are extremely important there. I've had an involvement in nuclear weapons for a long time as an activist, as a writer, an analyst, policy writer, if you like. I think ICANN was a remarkable organisation, and I look forward to seeing it do much more now. I think that one of the reasons why I was a latecomer to ICANN, I knew the people who were starting it, and I wished them well. But I was involved in what might be called reform work on nuclear weapons with my colleagues in the Nautilus Institute, particularly concentrating on working to get the idea of a Northeast Asia nuclear weapon-free zone on the agendas of the governments of all the governments of that region. And to some extent, we succeeded. But I was also doing work at the same time on climate change, and particularly climate change and security, which is a topic which is often pretty rubbishy, frankly, in the way it's conceived. But what was very clear to me was that every serious writer on climate change and security that I developed some respect for assumed that in the next 20 or 30 years we were still going to have nuclear weapons. And it became very clear that if one started to think about the kind of world where climate change, climate disruption more properly, becomes socially visible in the countries that Ramesh referred to so accurately as the countries that think they matter most, then we are in diabolical trouble. And it did, in fact, induce me to move more energy towards abolition efforts in that point. I think there are two acceptable positions on this matter. One is the kind of position which John Carlson epitomises, which is a deep and long-going, serious commitment to reform of the nuclear state and the nuclear establishment and the long-haul gradual grinding that involves. I think the other position is abolition, and I think it's absolutely urgent now to do that. Whether constructive engagement is the only way to proceed, I think that's actually a matter of tactics. There are times and there are places when, and certainly I always think that evidence-based work and based on research is extremely important, but there are times when simply hard opposition is important. And frankly, I think that's what the proponent governments decided to do. As Ramesh alluded to, there was a rebellion from the outsiders of the nuclear establishment, and it has not been appreciated by the five permanent members of the Security Council. I think there are now two competing trends, and they are both moving quite quickly and somewhat unpredictably. The first is about abolition, and I think all of the speakers have referred to the possibilities but also the limitations in some way of what the Nuclear Prohibition Treaty promises. And Ramesh in particular has laid out a pathway beyond that. The other, of course, is the possibility of incipient nuclear cascade. We see, forget about Trump, it's actually nuclear normality that worries me much more, to be perfectly honest. But if we look at the situation in Germany, we now see much more serious discussion of the need for Germany to consider indigenous nuclear weapons, clearly related to the geopolitical events to both the East and the West, if you like, there. In Japan, a country where there was for a very long time the situation where even to suggest we might think about nuclear weapons was unspeakable, literally, if you wanted to be a mainstream politician, that has long since passed. Across the water in the Republic of Korea, South Korea, which has undergone a remarkable democratisation since its dictatorship days, what is striking there is at least 55 to 60% of people in public opinion polls say South Korea ought to consider getting nuclear weapons. And then there's Saudi Arabia and countries like that. And there's also Australia, where former deputy secretaries of defence have in the last year advocated reconsidering the question of whether Australia should consider to abjure the bomb. And I'll come back to that in a little while. The treaty has already been outlined quite clearly to you, and it's fundamentally, as Ramesh said, the first time there's been an attempt simply to ban the bomb. No ifs or buts. The negative prohibitions are on use, possession, manufacture and transport and so forth, and they're fairly clear to understand. With the addition of one extra negative prohibition, which is very important for our country, which is a prohibition on assistance, inducement and encouragement to use or acquire or develop nuclear weapons. There are also two positive requirements in the treaty, which I feel some pride, in particular for ICAN's role, in particular to authorise rehabilitation of lands of nuclear sacrifice zones, the places where we have used and tested nuclear weapons, but also an injunction to support the efforts or the requirements and the needs of nuclear survivor peoples. And one of the small things that ICAN in Australia did was make it possible for a number of nuclear survivors from this country, but also from the Marshall Islands and French Polynesia, to attend the treaty negotiations. And one of the things we heard back consistently from diplomats was how important those messages were for nuclear survivors. Dips, with great affection, don't often get out a lot in society, and in particular to hear the really extraordinary tales of Hibakusha from Australia and those other parts of the world, particularly the colonies of the French Polynesia. There are flaws in the treaty, without a doubt. Nothing's perfect. It was a compromise like any other collective activity there. John's alluded to some of them, and I just want to make a couple of very quick comments about this. Firstly, there's been a suggestion that there's been supporters remorse because only 19 countries, as Ramesh pointed out, have ratified the treaty in the 13 months since it became open for ratification. More than 60 have signed it. What's interesting to note is that if you look at the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we are well ahead of the game there in terms of the number of countries which have ratified it. And certainly going back to the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, we are far ahead. My feeling is that ratification will take about 2 years or something like that. It will be a struggle. Some countries are reporting a lot of pressure against them, but I think that it will proceed. So I'm not concerned about that. It's not going to make nuclear weapons disappear when it comes into power, but it comes into force, which it will after 50 countries have ratified it, 50 signatories have ratified it. But it will, I think, begin the process that Ramesh has alluded to and Ambassador Zimberg has referred to, of beginning to delegitimate and to stigmatise the idea that some countries can arrogate to themselves the right to threaten not just their own or other countries' survival, but indeed quite possibly many, many more countries on a global scale. It's been said that it amounts to a regression in nuclear safeguards. I think nuclear safeguards and verification are absolutely central to what abolitionists need to talk about. I don't accept the argument that there is any significant undermining of existing safeguards. On the contrary, I think by the pathways outlined for accession to the treaty for nuclear possession states, demanding verifiable, complete and irreversible abolition of, or eradication of nuclear weapons, there is a new pathway there. But even looking at the fairly weak requirements of the IAEA's Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement and the additional protocol, it's clear that when we get to the point of verifying whether countries have actually given up their nuclear weapons, we are going to need much, much more than the IAEA has even dreamed of. And one of the problems now that I find in discussion about safeguards in relation to the treaty is that it's still stuck on the kind of nuclear materials accounting that the IAEA is currently concerned with. We need to see a wider package of verification measures which take some of the issues that, for example, the Nuclear Suppliers Group or the Missile Trade Control Regime add in to get a real sense of what is required and what we need to monitor and then verify in relation to the whole of the nuclear weapons apparatus and not simply the nuclear fuel cycle. It's been said that there are no hope of nuclear weapon states joining. Clearly, we can think of Mr. Trump very quickly. Of course, that is going to be a huge effort. We're going to be talking about decades there. But I would point you towards one development which was noted back in 2012 by William Walker, one of the most interesting and I think insightful of analysts of both the nuclear fuel cycle and nuclear weapons, when he dubbed the United Kingdom as perhaps a threshold nuclear disarmed country. He was thinking there of the breakup of the United Kingdom, the loss of Scotland, and therefore the loss of the fast lane nuclear bases for the Royal Navy. But of course, since then, there has been a great turnaround in British politics and a great deal more chaos. And I'd just like to invite you to think about what might have happened had the Brexit, the election in which Mr. Corbyn did so well for the Labour Party on a disarmament platform come a little bit earlier. I don't believe, and particularly I'm thinking there of the way in which Mrs. May, when she first arrived at Downing Street, in her, one of her first acts was to renew the Trident nuclear missile submarine program. I'm not saying that Britain is about to fall over, but there was a debate in Britain about that nuclear Trident renewal program, which was much more thoroughgoing than anywhere else in the world, as far as I know, where you had significant conservatives and military people saying, well, if you want us to go to Iraq and Afghanistan to save the world, why are you spending all this money on nuclear weapons? And by the way, isn't this simply something which is redundant and a kind of subset of the American nuclear weapon system? And wouldn't we be better off admitting that Great Britain is not so great anymore and we should look somewhere else? There is the possibility of a nuclear disarming country. It's a long way off, but it's not to be ignored. The other targets of the nuclear ban treaty very clearly are nuclear supporting countries such as Australia, such as Japan, South Korea, and the NATO countries that say they benefit from the American nuclear umbrella. I think, in fact, in Australia, this is really going to be extraordinarily important. It's going to take a very long time. For Australia to be compliant with the treaty, particularly the clause about prohibiting assistance, encouragement and inducement to use nuclear weapons, there are two problems, one fairly big and one huge. The fairly big one is the commitment in every government defence white paper since 1994 that Australia relies on assurances of American extended nuclear deterrence, nuclear protection, in the face of nuclear threats to this country. Now, you might wonder what nuclear threats there are to this country other than those that we attract by hosting the joint facilities, but that's another matter for the moment. I think that it is possible, and I'm happy to expand this in questions, actually, I think that nuclear protection doctrine is, in fact, politically a little bit vulnerable, not easily so. It's absurd, of course, because the Americans have given us no such assurance, where they do freely give it in NATO and in the East Asian allies, and that's for the simple reason they see us facing no important nuclear threat. It's also pretty obscene what we call our nuclear deterrent when other people have got it are simply weapons of mass destruction. And going to a point that Stefan, an old friend and probably the most, I think, seriously interesting person on the possibilities of assessing nuclear weapons use by Australia, Stefan's reliance on the ways in which both Russia and the United States are moving towards smaller nuclear weapons with lower yields or yields that can be dialed down, I'm not so optimistic about that. That's precisely what I'm worried about, because it opens the door to usable nuclear weapons and the possibility of escalation follow on from that. I take the position that nuclear weapons in all but a number of fairly unreal isolated cases, a small ship at sea a long way from anywhere else, the use of nuclear weapons is inherently genocidal in the broader sense of the term, and I think we need to call that one out. So I think going back to extended nuclear deterrence in Australia, we can think about the possibility and we will see campaigns about that. A second thing, of course, much larger problem, is the fact that one of the joint facilities and possibly one other are very intimately involved with United States nuclear command and control requirements for conducting nuclear weapons. And I'm talking about Pine Gap. The question that really, that's a complicated question, but clearly Pine Gap puts us in the category of assisting the use of nuclear weapons. Can Pine Gap be reformed? Is it possible, if we had a government that had the political will, to say to the United States, we accept some parts of the operations of Pine Gap, but not these, and will you kindly comply? Otherwise, we're happy to continue in our normal alliance relationships. Is that conceivable? Is that possible? Is it technically possible? That's really hard to answer at the moment. Politically, I think it's extremely difficult to foresee that coming in the very near future, but that's what we need to see in this country. I want to finish just on one thing, and it's been mentioned several times already, and that's to do with the new information we have from climate scientists about the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons. This goes back to the 1980s and the debate associated with people like Carl Sagan and his colleagues in both North America and Europe under what was called the nuclear winter hypothesis, which was roughly to say that if there is a substantial nuclear exchange and detonations in a number of countries and cities burning, very large amounts of smoke and ash will be lofted into the atmosphere. This will spread around the world. It will diminish the sunlight reaching the Earth's surface, both reducing photosynthesis and reducing temperatures quite dramatically. There were a number of important criticisms of that, including some by my research colleague here, the late Des Ball, about that. There are a number of variables involved in that. For example, will the rain wash out some of that soot that reaches the atmosphere? Will it all be so black that it absorbs heat, or will some of it be reflected back out again? Some cities are more liable to be burning vast amounts than others. Some are more densely populated than others, and so forth. That was an important debate in the 1980s. Today, with the vastly more capable climate change models that we have as a result of climate disruption and scientific concern about it, we now know much more about this. And there is now a firm body of peer-reviewed scientific study based on open, transparent scenarios about the possibilities of nuclear winter. The most important studies have been done by a group of scientists in the United States who use as their baseline a war between India and Pakistan. As you know, they each have about 100 nuclear weapons each. And in this modelling, they presume that each country will use 15 kiloton nuclear weapons against each other, principally on large towns and cities. 15 kilotons was the size of the yield of the bomb on Hiroshima, and of course today that's a very unusually small amount. But there are some weapons like that. In other words, 100 small nuclear explosions. The modelling is now very clear and has been tested very carefully. This will result in vast amounts of smoke and other carboniferous material going not just into the lower atmosphere, the troposphere where the weather is, but reaching into the upper atmosphere, stratosphere and beyond, past where the rain is, past where rain will bring that material out. The modelling shows very clearly it spreads around the northern hemisphere first, very quickly, and then around the southern hemisphere, covering much of the world apart from the polar areas. The effects on agriculture have been modelled very carefully under a number of different scenarios. They result in drops of temperature, drops of growing, shortening of growing season, and diminished growth patterns because of photosynthesis, which mean there is a likelihood on these scenarios of economic collapse and agricultural collapse in particular, resulting in famines leading to the deaths of possibly 2 billion people. Now, there are arguments to be had here, but there are no substantial scientific criticisms that have been that have survived scrutiny here. I say all this not to say, well, isn't nuclear war terrible in itself? That is so obvious. But rather to say to my colleagues in my own trade, in international relations, security studies, defence studies, I think what we're seeing is the intellectual bankruptcy of parts of those disciplines, particularly those who maintain that nuclear deterrence is a viable pathway to security. As numerous speakers today have said, if you have nuclear weapons, sooner or later, they are going to be used. And India and Pakistan are, as Stefan pointed out, very dangerous parts of the world at the moment, but they are big players in the global nuclear scene. It seems to me now very clear that there is no intellectually credible account of deterrence in realistic frameworks that go beyond very small signalling uses of nuclear deterrence, such as Stefan alluded to there, but ones with, when you look at the ones which are actually planned, which are part of not just the nuclear posture review, but the daily planning in Moscow and Washington to rehearse and to refine the planning, it seems to me it is not possible with any intellectual credibility to maintain that nuclear deterrence is a pathway to security, national security, human security, or indeed global security. The nuclear ban treaty is not perfect. It's not about going to bring heaven tomorrow. But as Ambassador Zimberg and Ramesh Thakur have outlined so clearly, it is a promising start to making those countries which have nuclear weapons and those countries like ours which support, freely support, with not much consideration of the consequences, it will begin to make them feel very uncomfortable and to have to justify their reliance on nuclear defence in some other language than the, I think, completely discredited doctrine of nuclear deterrence. Thanks very much.